morning, and that book that I was just looking at is actually the book we're going to be learning about today. So I'll explain as we get to it, but that's an incredible thing to see. Our topic for today is really a bridge from last week, because last week we only started on the topic briefly, and now we're continuing it. But we were talking about we finished talking about the censorship of Jewish books, and moved on to talk about publishing wars. And we set the stage by talking. There's a lot to discuss today, so I'm launching right in. I hope that's okay. But we set the stage by talking about how in the early days of the printing press, the Italians jump right in, and the Jews are involved until in the middle of the 16th century, 1547, Jews are banned from running printing presses themselves, and instead Christians take over the field, and they hire Jews or Jews who had converted to Christianity to work for them in order to produce Hebrew books. We have here sheets for week 3. You still need the sheets from week 2, from last week. That's what we're on right now. But the case that I want to talk about is the case of Marco Antonio Giustiniani and Alvise Bragadini. So Giustiniani, we started talking about him last week, was not Jewish, as all the printers we're going to talk about were not Jewish. And he established a Hebrew printing press in Venice in the year 1545. He was a nobleman from a family of patricians, and he was a cutthroat rival to someone else we mentioned last week, Daniel Bamberg, who was the publisher of Mikraot Gedolot, the popular edition of the Chumash, of the biblical text. And he pledged in a public ad that he was going to provide everything from Talmud to more recent writings and new printing with beautiful print and paper, and it would all be less expensive, and everybody would be grateful to him for what he's providing for the Jewish world, for their studies. What he was really doing was undercutting Bamberg on cost and on pricing. He did not do the high-quality work that he promised. His value came in adding an index to a book or in adding some translations, illuminations, but he basically copied Bamberg's work. That was more or less what he was doing. And we mentioned last time, but at the very end, like in 1545, Bamberg publishes a work called Midrash Rabbah, which is one of the earliest bodies of Midrash, of rabbinic explanation of biblical text, to be published. It goes back 2,000 years ago when it was canonized. But he publishes it in 1545. And Giustiniani does the same. This is we're not on the sheet yet. In 1546, Bamberg publishes a grammar work by Rabbi David Kimchi. It had originally been written in the 14th century, I believe, 13th or 14th. And Giustiniani then comes out with two editions of this work, one of which he brings in a Latin translation. So he keeps competing with Bamberg. The editions add content, but not quality. And that's a way that he's able to save on his costs, and he's able to charge less. Sometimes Bamberg prints original texts that have been licensed to him by the Venetian Senate, so Giustiniani can't copy them. So instead what he'll do is he'll print texts that are from the same category of book. So, for example, in 1547, Bamberg publishes a book called Sefer Mitzvot Gadol, which is a collection of all of the commandments in the Torah and an explanation of each. So Giustiniani publishes also a similar work of Jewish law called Kolbo. And so it goes back and forth between them. And ultimately, Giustiniani succeeds in putting Bamberg out of business. In 1548, 1549, for a short time, he is the only Hebrew printer in Venice. And that is what we got up to last time in this. So again, you want the sheet that's for week 2, not the week 3 sheet yet. But this brings in Rabbi Meir of Padua. Rabbi Meir of Padua, his full name, Meir ben Isaac Katzenellenbogen, but it's easier to write Padua than Katzenellenbogen, I think. He was a leading rabbinical authority and scholar in Jewish law of his day. He was born in Katzenellenbogen in Germany in 1473. He studied in Prague. And then he moves to Padua, which is located in the Republic of Venice. It is a seat of both secular and Jewish learning. It draws students from all over Europe. And Rabbi Meir succeeds his father-in-law as the chief rabbi of Padua in the year 1525. He is the head of the rabbinical court for the Republic of Venice. He is the head of the Venetian Regional Council of Rabbis. He is the head of the renowned Academy of Padua, the Yeshiva in Padua. He's a big name. Well, he writes a commentary to Maimonides' key work of law called Mishneh Torah. And let me digress for a minute just to explain what this Mishneh Torah is about. For those who were looking at the big book before, that was Mishneh Torah that we were looking at. Jewish law, and some of you have heard this from me before, I'll say it relatively quickly, but Jewish law until the beginning of the Common Era is passed along verbally. You know what you know by tradition and by debate that goes on in yeshiva, and that's how you know what you're supposed to do in any given circumstance based on the laws that you've received. The problem is that with everything being passed along verbally, everyone has to memorize everything. So number one, that's difficult. Number two, living under oppression, as the Jews are at that point from the Roman Empire, that makes it still more challenging. And number three, as we've discussed on other occasions, the Romans put an effective halt to this transmission of the tradition by decreeing that anybody who is caught teaching Torah will be killed, the student will be killed as well, and if you ordain a rabbi, they will kill the ordaining court, they will also kill the ordainee and the Jewish community, the Jewish population of the nearest community. At that point, you're not able to pass things along verbally, because verbally requires that there be a teacher and a student sitting together to learn. So these factors lead the sages to say, we weren't supposed to write this down. It was supposed to be passed along verbally for many reasons. When something is passed along verbally, it has flexibility. You can discuss, you can ask, what do I do in this case? What do I do in that case? When something is passed along verbally, if the student doesn't understand, they can ask the teacher, what did that mean? If I study from a text, it's up to me to figure out what the writer meant. When something is passed along verbally, you have control. You know who is going to learn it, and you can make sure that you keep it out of the hands of those you don't want to. Let's say there's something in there that you're afraid that the Christians will be offended by. It's no problem. We're just going to teach it to those we trust. That's the way it's passed down initially. But when they realize they have no choice, they record first what's called the Mishnah, a basic outline of Jewish law. That is canonized finally in the beginning of the 3rd century Common Era. And then after that, a couple of centuries later, they complete a commentary on that called Gemara. Together, Mishnah plus Gemara equals Talmud. So that's already the 6th century Common Era. You have Talmud. But Talmud is not written in a style that lends itself to easy reading and consulting. Talmud is 2,700 pages, double-sided, so 5,400 pages, in the standard edition that's used today. It is a bit meandering, Babylonian Talmud, more than the version of it that was canonized in the land of Israel, but it's fairly meandering because it follows debates that went on in the study hall. So you can start in one place and end up in some place that's entirely different. There are digressions. There are elements that aren't law-related. There is no index in the original. There is no chapter and verse. There are volumes, and volumes have chapters within them, but it's not easy reading, and it's not easy for reference. They manage with it. Eventually, 9th century, 10th century or so, sages begin to collect sections out of it that deal directly with law and put them together as separate volumes to make consultation easier. But it's still a big challenge. And then along comes Maimonides. Maimonides, who passed away 810 years ago, comes up with a different way of doing things. And what he does is to create what is intuitive to us today, a legal code made up of 14 separate divisions, each division dealing with a particular area of Jewish law. So one, let's say, is Zra'im, which deals with agriculture. Another one is Kedushah, dealing with issues of holiness. Beit HaBechira, dealing with the laws of the temple. And he attempts to put all of Jewish law in these 14 different sections, each one, you know, assigning it its own space, and that becomes known as Mishneh Torah, which is a term referring to a summary of Torah. And his vision is, you can study this, and you will know everything you need to know about Jewish practice. That's what Maimonides does. And another name for his work is Yad HaChazakah, Yad being the Hebrew word for a hand. Yad HaChazakah is the mighty hand. There are numerous reasons why he uses that, but the word yad itself, yud dalet for the Hebrew speakers, the letters yud and dalet have a numerical value of 14. Like if in English you were to say A is 1 and B is 2 and C is 3 and so on, so yud dalet will be 14, and it has 14 divisions. So that's why it's called yad hachazaka, the mighty yad, the mighty 14. It revolutionizes everything in terms of the study of law. Because no longer do I have to read debates and figure out who won the debate and so on. And no longer do I have to hunt through a text. He's simply telling me this is what we do. Mind you, he gains enemies for doing so because he has decided how we rule in various debates and not everybody agrees with him. So, yeah, that part of it is controversial, plus the fact that he decided not to quote his sources. In other words, he doesn't tell you, if you want to know more about this, look at such and such a place. If you want to know why I decided this way, look at this source. He doesn't bother with that. He has created what he believes is the ultimate reference work, and you don't really need to go back to the original, so to speak. You can just read what he wrote. And again, that rubs some people the wrong way. But that's his Mishneh Torah, which is really a fundamental work that everything afterwards relies upon in a major way. Whether you agree with him on a law, on a particular law or not, you can't go anywhere in Jewish law without dealing with Maimonides. It is a foundation text in Jewish law. 300, 400 years later, they would come up with a newer and more efficient way to codify law and to present it that would lead ultimately to the Shulchan Aruch, to the Code of Jewish Law. But even still, his work remains critical to this day. So, having said that, Maharam, Rabbi Meir of Padua, I should say, he's also known as Maharam, but Rabbi Meir of Padua says, I am going to publish a new edition of this Mishneh Torah, this Yad HaChazakah, this work of law from Maimonides. It has corrections of earlier editions that he has come up with, as well as corrections to the medieval commentators whose work often appears along with Maimonides' work. He also annotates the text. He adds references to Talmudic sources where Maimonides did not. And he adds a brief commentary of his own. Not only that, but in this edition that he envisions, he wants to incorporate the commentaries that have been included in earlier editions, as well as several more texts. And he says, I want to publish this. And so he approaches Marc Antonio Giustiniani, and he says, I would like you to handle the printing. But the two do not come to terms. And so he joins forces instead with Alvise Bragadin, or Bragadini, as I've also seen it written. Alvise, like the others, is a non-Jewish printer. He is a noble. He also prints Hebrew books. And his house, in the year 1550, publishes Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, his work of law, using not only the edition prepared by Rabbi Meir of Padua, but also using his financial investment. He's got skin in the game. He invests in the publishing of the work, because that was the way, that's the way it went in those days. You hope to recoup by then when people buy the book. But that was the idea. Well, Giustiniani responds by publishing a new version, using, including within his version, Rabbi Meir of Padua's source references and commentary. Now, which version was it that you were showing me? You were showing me the Bragadini one. Sorry, you were showing me the original, well, the Giustiniani one. That's all right. If you take a look on your sheets from last time, source number 3, the sheets that say week 2 at the top. For those who don't have it, if you could maybe look on with somebody else. But this comes from the front page. Sorry? Yeah, the Bragadini one. Okay. What I have here in source number 3 comes from the front page of the Giustiniani edition. Okay, this is the competitor edition, the second one in the game. And look at what he has on the front page. We have also decided, in describing his work, we have also decided to print at the end that which was written on the page by one sage, head of the rabbis of Padua, Rabbi Meir, new each morning. And what he's doing there is a play on a verse from the book of Echa of Lamentations, Chadashim LaBekarim. And what he's doing is he's saying this newcomer, somebody who was just, you know, born yesterday, so to speak, this fellow, Rabbi Meir of Padua, who wrote of his own heart in the Maimonidean edition printed anew by Bragadin, introducing his head between the early giants. which is another classic, it's such a Talmudic phrase for somebody who puts his head where he doesn't belong in a debate that's, you know, above his level. So he has stuck his head between the giants. We reprinted it. We consulted wise and complete people near and far, and in truth, they counseled us not to print them in this book. We shouldn't bother with Rabbi Meir's comments, lest they not appear correct to many students of Torah, as will be clear to any who examines one preface on the other side of this page. Just read a little bit and you'll see that he doesn't know what he's talking about. But in truth, we printed them to satisfy the desire of every man. And they quote a verse from Esther, doing the will of each man. We want to satisfy everybody. So we even included Rabbi Meir of Padua, even though we don't actually think that he knew what he was doing when he wrote his commentary. It's the ultimate insult on the front page of the edition that competes with his edition. You follow? That's what, yeah.
Did he think that true, or he just did it like that?
I think it's just an insult. It's just, yeah. Yeah, that would be my sense of it, yeah. So the reason he prints it fundamentally is because he wants to compete, and people want to buy an edition that has this, so he's going to include it in it. But he's also going to put it down at the same time. Now, this edition, the Justiniani edition, is cheaper. He says, I want to let the Jewish community purchase books as cheaply as possible. And to add insult to injury, he moves Rabbi Meir's commentary to an appendix and says, you know, this is worthless and so on. He even announces that scholars have pleaded with him, don't rush this out. It's a very ugly thing that he does. It leads to a new development in Jewish copyright law. Emerges from this incident in which Justiniani comes out with a text that Bragadini has published first. And this is one of the reasons that I said it last week for why we're looking at this. You see, secular copyright law only really begins, as I understand it, with the Statute of Anne in 1709. And it rests on several principles. Number one, One approach to copyright law in secular law is an author owns the right to the fruits of his labor. The author has the right to it. You can't copy that which I have created because I own that which I created. Let me take a step back because I just realized I didn't unpack everything that I really ought to. Why do you need a separate body of copyright law separate from the laws of, let's say, not stealing? Why does a system of law need copyright law?
Because people take advantage of the creator and they, you know, they take advantage of it, make money on it, and he has no recall.
But why is it not automatically assumed within the laws of theft?
Once you put the book out there, anybody can read it and interpret it in their particular light. Consequently, there has to be some way of protecting the individual.
More than that. Sorry?
It's a form of plagiarism.
Well, it's theft. We'll get to plagiarism next in the next topic. But the...
It's proper, it's intellectual property.
Yeah. Good.
I know what I mean.
Okay, the problem fundamentally is that there's no object. There's no object. When you're talking about intellectual property, that means, literally, there's nothing there that you can physically point to. In other words, I have a book, okay? I put my book down on the table. Somebody else comes along, opens it up, and copies the book, writes it down on something else, and he's going to go publish it, right? That's my manuscript. I've been working for 7 years on this manuscript, and he just took it and ripped it off, right? But when you say, well, what did he steal? It's information that he stole. The arrangement of words. But fundamentally, my book is still here. And that's why that's why you can't just say, well, we already have laws that say don't steal, so you can't steal this. It's not true. Our laws are about stealing physical items. In fact, the argument goes in some quarters, I didn't take anything. Right? Think of downloading music. The original file is still there. All I've done is make a copy of it. So what's wrong? I provided my own materials. I am providing the hard drive that now is hosting this. You know, I did the work of copying it.
He stole the idea, the theory, he stole it. Or it was stolen.
What does that mean, it's stolen? He still has it.
No, I meant whoever took it.
Yeah, but the original person still has it. I didn't take it away from him. Yes.
But there's also no way to prove that I didn't think of this on my own also.
Right. So that makes things even more complicated in terms of pursuing it. Absolutely.
You're using the exact language of the original.
Well, you know, an infinite number of monkeys, an infinite number of typewriters.
Right.
I mean, only monkeys would still use typewriters. But yeah, the infinite number of monkeys on an infinite number of iPhones. Well, the...
That autocorrects.
Yes. So one argument is that even though it's not a physical object, nonetheless, the author owns the rights to it. That's the way it works. The author owns the rights to this, to the labor that the author did, and what you're doing is stealing the author's labor. That's one argument. A second argument is completely different. Society needs copyright law in order to encourage the advancement of learning. Meaning, if you aren't going to protect the rights of a creator, people will stop investing in creating things. Because they're going to say, I worked really hard on creating this, and then they all took it away from me. Why should I? I can't even afford to devote the time and energy needed. I'm going to take time off from whatever else and not earn a living in order to write this book, record this music, whatever it is, and then there will be no remuneration for it. I'm going to starve. So according to this theory, government steps in and says, technically speaking, it's not theft. However, we're going to call it theft in order to ensure that society will have people who will do this kind of research, who will do this kind of writing, who will create this kind of art, because we need to make sure that society will have such things. That's a second approach. A third approach is that it's a trade regulation. The government is able to say, we want things traded in certain ways, we want to create rules for, you know, what's fair in terms of competition, and that's a third approach. There's a fourth approach that says that copyright is not economic at all. Rather, it's that whatever you create is an extension of your body. And therefore, it's like part of you. All sorts of theories. Fundamentally, my point in with this preface is to explain that until the modern age, and modern, I mean less than 400 years, you don't really have any form of copyright law in secular law. And you don't have it either until it's not the 18th century, but until the beginning of the 16th century, you don't have it in Jewish law. You don't have a source that says, no, you can't copy somebody else's work under this this sort of heading of copyright law. If you take a look at source number 4, they're talking about what's called in Hebrew kinyan. Kinyan is transaction or transfer. So what it says here in the Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch, one may transfer through sale or gift only items of substance. Intangible items may not be transferred. We don't have a method for transferring something that is intangible, giving a right to somebody else. Now they own, let's say, the right to copy this work, to put it in the context of what we're talking about. It's only the tangible that's going to be dealt with. But then you have this case in which Rabbi Meir has had his work taken by Justiniani, and taken by Justiniani. Bragadini was the one who published the legitimate version. He has now had his own work taken by Justiniani and published in Justiniani's edition along with the insult on the front page. But even aside from the insult, you stole my work. You stole my commentary. By what right do you get to publish this? So he calls up, so to speak, his cousin. His cousin is Rabbi Moshe Isserles. Rabbi Moshe Isserles was very young at this time. Remember that I mentioned before that after Maimonides has his code of law that he creates, a couple hundred years later comes the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. The Shulchan Aruch is an attempt to improve on the arrangement of law that you find in Maimonides' work, and also to bring into consideration the competing views of other sages who didn't agree with Maimonides, and digest it down to a practical code of law. And it's initially written by Rabbi Yosef Karo, who is a Turkish rabbi who ends up in Israel in Tzfat. But his views tend to present the Sephardic way of looking at things. Rabbi Moshe Isserles is the rabbi in Krakow in the middle of the 16th century, early to mid-16th century, and he writes comments on it that represent what Polish Jews are doing, Ashkenazi practice, and the two ultimately blend together to become the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law. So, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, at this time, is very young. This is the year 1550. He is at this point, depending on which historian you ask, either 20 or 30 years old, Rabbi Isserles. So extremely young in terms of being a rabbinic authority, but he has just been appointed the rabbi of Krakow. He's on his way to becoming the leading Ashkenazi authority of his day. Well, Rabbi Isserles is particularly appealing for Rabbi Meir of Padua. First of all, they are, as I mentioned, second cousins. Second cousins once removed, technically. Also, they are aligned on various issues in Jewish thought and in Jewish law. They're both rationalists. They're both committed to the study of science. They're both supporters of the idea of codifying Jewish law and selecting which view everybody follows and publishing works like that. They philosophically, they're close. So Rabbi Isserles hears the case, this lawsuit that he has, essentially, against this edition that's been published by Justiniani. Well, the overview of this is that, indeed, Rabbi Isserles sides with Rabbi Meir of Padua. And I'm going to give you a brief rundown of what he decides. He says, Rabbi Meir has an exclusive right to sell out his already printed edition before Justiniani or anybody else will be allowed to offer a competing edition. Okay, no one will be able to compete with that first edition because he has to have the opportunity to recover the investment that he has already made. However, he says, the author has no enduring proprietary right to his labor. Meaning, once he has protected and recovered his original investment, that run is done, then anybody can copy what he did. And he says, Rabbi Isserles says, the non-Jewish publisher, Mark Antonio Justiniani, is bound to follow this ruling, even though he's not Jewish. Because one of the Noahide laws, one of the commandments that's supposed to apply to all human beings, is to have a court system. And he says this comes under that. This is part of having a system of law. But he presents four reasons for why he has ruled in favor of Rabbi Meir of Padua. And I'm going to go through it a little bit quickly so we can also get to our next topic, at least in some measure today. But he gives four reasons for it. His first point is the rules of fair and unfair competition. I brought it for you in source number 6, but I'm just going to recite it for you. I'll tell you about it without referring to 6 and 7. But what we're talking about here is unfair competition. We have a tradition going back to biblical times and biblical law saying that you're not allowed to overstep the boundary of another. The biblical verse, Lo tasig gvul re'acha, you're not allowed to step over the boundary of somebody else. Which you could take in a very narrow frame as your field ends here, his field only starts there, therefore you're not allowed to enter into his field. Don't overstep his boundary. Don't try to use part of his property for yourself. You're going to plant it and you're going to take the harvest. That would be a very narrow way to look at it. But the sages, going back a couple of thousand years, understood it more expansively. And what they understood the text to be saying is that you can't compete unfairly with somebody else. And they give all sorts of examples, and there are many debates. But one example, which is the one that I brought you in source number 6, is in the following case. You have an alley, and when I say an alley, what I mean is the street is, let's say, at that end of the table, it runs this way for those on the audio, the street runs this way, and then coming off of the street, you have a side street, which comes down here and terminates at the end of the table, no other entry to this alley. You follow?
Dead end.
Dead end, exactly. I, sitting right here where I am, okay, I have a business. my business is, I don't know, I'm a tailor. Okay?
For ladies.
Yeah, I'm a tailor. I'm going to go with a tailor. So, I have my tailor shop, and I'm doing okay here. Along comes somebody else who wants to go into business as a tailor. And he sets up shop where Katie is sitting. Which means anybody coming off of the street looking for a tailor is going to go to Katie first.
Whoops.
And I am out of luck. You follow the problem. So the Talmud discusses this case, and you see in source number 7 the commentary from the Mordechai. Mordechai was Rabbi Mordechai ben Hillel, who commented on this. And what he said is, we could actually prevent that person from starting the tailor shop where Katie is. Even though technically he'll say, I didn't take anything away from you, you're still operating as a tailor. Nonetheless, that's called unfair competition. And Rabbi Isserles says, this is a broad mandate to be able to interpret in each generation for its time what exactly is prohibited under the laws of fair and unfair competition. And that's his first point. He says, it's unfair competition for you to take the work that he did and then publish it so that he can benefit from his work. That's number one. Number two, he argues, and I brought it in source number 8, that it is important to support Torah scholars. So he says, it's that Rabbi Meir of Padua who put in all this time and all this work. Just like in the secular system, there's a desire to make sure there will be authors and artists and so on. Within the Jewish world, we want to make sure there will be people studying and developing. This is the R&D division of Judaism. You need people who will be doing research and development. So you can't undercut them, take away their livelihood, and then you won't have a research and development division. So therefore, you need to do this. Number three, he argues that as a general rule, he wants to see you buy Jewish. He says, realistically, there are two editions out there. There's the Bragadin edition and there's the Justiniani edition. The Bragadin edition, when you buy that, some of the money is going to Rabbi Meir. If you buy the Justiniani edition, then it's just going to Justiniani. And he argues that you're supposed to be supporting your family. This is not a statement about Jews and non-Jews and the like. This is simply a statement of, this is your family, therefore you are responsible to support him. And then finally he says, and it's, if you flip the sheet to source number 10, he says, Rabbi Meir of Padua put in a lot of work to make sure that the text that he used was accurate. And you're not allowed to keep around Torah texts that are not accurate. A Sefer Torah is the case. A Torah scroll is the case. I brought you in number 10. So therefore, you have to buy the Justiniani edition. And so he argues for creating what is effectively copyright law. He's writing this 150 years before the Statute of Anne, but that's what he's doing. And he's basing it on Talmudic ideas that are from 1,500 years and more before his time about fair and unfair competition. It's really a remarkable thing, and it applies down till today. And it's this case is often cited in discussing the downloading MP3s type of a question, or downloading a movie that's been leaked. That this comes into that discussion. But there's more that emerges from this. Well, the first thing that emerges from it is that Bragadin manages to put Justiniani out of business. That's actually what ends up happening. And Bragadin comes to dominate Hebrew printing in Venice until well into the 18th century. That's number one. But number two is that this leads to the burning of the Talmud in Italy. Because Bragadin decides he's going to print his edition of the Talmud, 1551 to 1553. Justiniani hires Jews who have converted to Christianity to go to Rome and to tell Pope Julius III negative things about the Talmud in order to prevent Bragadin from getting to print his edition. If you take a look on your sheet, it's source number 12. From Marvin Heller, Further Studies in the Making of the Early Hebrew Book. Anticipating a loss on his investment, Justiniani and his concern about his investment in an edition of the Talmud, Justiniani appealed to Pope Julius III for relief. The Pope assigned the Justiniani-Bragadin dispute to a committee of six cardinals, the Congregation of the Inquisition, for investigation. The committee was headed by Cardinal Giovanni Pietro Caraffa. We mentioned him when we talked about censorship. The future Pope Paul IV. Both sides were represented by apostates, Jews who had converted to Christianity, whose charges soon deteriorated into an attack on the Talmud. It goes from being a fight between printers to being an attack on the Talmud. Under Caraffa's direction, the committee reported in favor of burning the Talmud, and on August 12, 1553, the Pope issued a bull ordering the confiscation and burning of the Babylonian and the Jerusalem Talmuds. On the Jewish New Year, September 19, 1553, Rosh Hashanah, the Talmud was burned first in Rome and then elsewhere. And so you get this public burning of the Talmud. We've talked already, we talked last week about the impact that such a burning had. We dealt with it from 1240, 1263. In the 13th century, the impact of this is horrific. It's not as extensive as it was in the 13th century because now you have a printing press. And therefore, there's a greater possibility of recovering. But it's horrific nonetheless. There were other interesting results of these publishing wars. The position, as I mentioned, of Rabbi Isserles becomes relevant in other cases going forward, other intellectual property cases. Another element that happens is the Haskama evolves. Remember last week I mentioned the Haskama. Haskama, literally an agreement, was originally an approval by the rabbis of, you may publish this book, we've checked and the censors aren't going to do anything to it. We already pre-checked your book. That was originally what it was. But now it becomes something else. The Haskama becomes a license by a rabbinical court saying only this author is authorized to publish this book and no one else may print this and publish it. So it changes in its use, this rabbinic approbation in the beginning of the book. And then finally, from the perspective of Jewish law, it's fascinating because what happens if you have a nation that's trying to follow a certain set of laws for which they rely on a particular text and you remove that text?
They make their own laws.
Oh boy. Make their own laws? I suppose if they have nothing else to turn to, then that's what would happen. But otherwise what happens is they find another text to be their foundation text. Well, Rabbi Yosef Karo, who I mentioned as the author of the Shulchan Aruch, of the Code of Jewish Law, has written an earlier work before this called Beit Yosef, and then he writes the Code of Jewish Law. But the result of the burning of the Talmud and these fights about publishing Mishneh Torah of Maimonides, one result is that it elevates the role of Rabbi Yosef Karo's work. And the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, gains in importance because we don't have these other works to use. That's the reference I gave you in source number 13 from Amnon Raz Krakatskin, Persecution and the Art of Printing. That the burning of the Talmud actually extends the role of Rabbi Karo's work. Both because that's a work now we're going to rely on, but also because he has many quotations from the Talmud, and so they can study that way. Yes, Marina.
So just to summarize things, The burning of the Talmud is because of the fighting between the two printers.
That particular burning is an outgrowth of this fight between the printers.
Neither of them were Jewish.
Correct. That was my opening line, I think, when we started this topic. It's absolutely crazy, and that's Jewish history for you. It is a bizarre and entirely true story about how a fight between two printers, two non-Jewish printers, led to the burning of the Talmud. Okay, that brings us to our next topic. Yes.
Can you just say again, please, the year that the Shulchan Aruch became finalized?
So you didn't miss it. I didn't mention it. It's The Rabbi Karo's edition is somewhere in the first decade of the 16th century, maybe second decade. Rabbi Isserles writes his comments on it in the 1550s.
So somewhere around there it becomes...
It's already... Right. It's been a major work before... It was a major work before Rabbi Isserles wrote his comments on it. Consider this, right? Rabbi Karo was living in Sfat. Right, in Israel. In the 16th century, not a great time for managing to carry things internationally, right? And certainly across bodies of water. Not a great time within the Jewish world either for that sort of thing. You're dealing with inquisitions and expulsions. And yet Rabbi Isserles in Krakow has access to this work, sees it as important, and is writing a commentary on it, and actually communicates, we know, with Rabbi Karo. In Sfat. So that tells you something about the way this work spread. this was like lightning. This was accepted.
I wanted to just ask about the copyright laws.
Yeah.
Initially, were they for only one jurisdiction, or were they universal?
You're talking about Jewish or general?
Jewish.
So, generally speaking, when you're dealing with Jewish law, and certainly in that era, authority is local. Rabbi Isserles has given this ruling. Let's say a dispute comes up next in the Jewish community in Morocco or in Turkey, so they're going to go to their rabbis, who may have access to Rabbi Isserles' ruling and may take it into consideration, but if they choose to disagree, they'll disagree. Yeah.
Like the use of precedent.
Yeah. Except that, as I understand it, the use of precedent in secular law has status just because it's precedent, even without the logic that goes with it. Whereas here, the value of it is greater because of its logic than because it came first. Unless you're talking about really different eras when we do talk about precedent in that sense. So this brings me to topic number three, and I would love to spend more time on that one, but again, we're up against the deadline, which is that next week is the last session. So topic number three, I called it on your sheet Modern Forgeries, and I'll change that title in a moment, but just to talk about what we want to accomplish here. We're going to learn about two instances of modern era forgery, where someone produced a text and claimed that that text was actually an ancient work when it was not. We'll learn about the impact of the technology of printing on the success of these forgeries. And we'll also, I think, get an understanding of the importance of authorship attribution in Jewish tradition. How important it is who wrote a book. Not just what's in the book, but who the author of the book is. I mentioned that it's not exactly a forgery. The correct term for what happened is actually, and I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, pseudepigraphy. Pseudepigraphy. Pseud like pseudo. False. Epigraphy. Like epigraphy. It's the attribution of a work to somebody who didn't write it. Claiming that the book was written by somebody who never wrote it. It's not exactly a forgery, as much as it is a claim that this book was written by somebody else. Why would you write a book and put somebody else's name on it?
Because they have more gravitas in the community.
Precisely. Sorry? Authenticity, well, the opposite of authenticity. But you want to give it authenticity. Right. You want to say that this book was written by some great figure, some people will accept it.
And buy it.
Well, buy it not necessarily. Because as you'll see, we're dealing with cases in which people do not gain commercial success from what they do. You're talking about people who are doing this ideologically. They're not doing it commercially. And they're not doing it, it appears, for any reputation purpose because they're not claiming authorship. Now, it could be that had they succeeded with it, then they would have come out later and said, aha, clearly I'm a great scholar because you thought that Rabbi so-and-so wrote this, and in fact I wrote it. But when we get to the guts of what happened, certainly in the first of the two cases, we see that it's much more about ideology. But before we go into the actual cases, I want to talk a little bit about this practice of signing someone else's name to your work. If you take a look... Yeah? Well, plagiarism is the opposite. Plagiarism is when I take someone else's book and sign my name. Here, I wrote a book and signed someone else's name. Right? It's the exact opposite. That doesn't make it a good thing to do, but it's anti-plagiarism, effectively. If you take a look at source number one, Pirkei Avot. Pirkei Avot, the classic ethical work, as well as a work on the importance of Torah study, says the following in source number one. One who makes a statement in the name of its original source, bless you, brings redemption to the world. As Esther 2:22 says, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordechai. It's a reference to the Purim story. We are slowly making our way towards Purim, right? 6 weeks now. The in that story, remember that in the beginning of the book, Mordechai finds out about a plot against the king, and he tells Esther, who tells the king, right? And the king is saved from the plot. And then later in the book, Mordechai is honored because he saved the king's life from this plot, but only because Esther had told the king that in fact it was Mordechai who gave the word. Now how that plays into the bigger story there is a great discussion for another time. Because there are different strands going on in that book, and it's not clear where that particular strand leads. But the point that they're making here, the sages are making in Pirkei Avot a couple of thousand years ago, is the only reason that Mordechai ends up being rewarded is because Esther told the king. She could have just as easily said, you know, I heard about a plot. She didn't have to give him credit. Giving him credit leads to great results. And so we're taught, in general, you have to give credit to the person who actually wrote it. Yes, Marianne.
Sounds pretty smart.
Esther?
Yeah.
Oh, very. There's a lot more to say about Esther and just how smart she was. People do not appreciate the role that she has in the book of Esther. I think we did a class on it a few years ago.
Can
you
we
were there.
Learn some of her tricks?
Sorry?
Can we learn some of her tricks?
A lot of them involve wine. You have to know that. So that's one source saying that you have to report things in the name of their originators. That doesn't mean I can't report something in the name of somebody else, giving credit to somebody else. But take a look at source number two, and you find a very interesting passage. The sages were very conflicted about the Greek language. On the one hand, Greek, and particularly in the Roman Empire, held a recognized, esteemed place within society. Right? They weren't speaking Latin. They were speaking Greek. The Greek was considered to be elevated. It was the language of philosophy and so on. On the other hand, Greek represented Roman culture. And Roman culture for Jews living under the Romans was a no-no. And so we find some sources in Jewish tradition that ban the study of Greek, also out of concern for the idea that studying Greek will lead you to study Greek philosophy. And Greek philosophy in those days meant something that would take you very far from Jewish ideas. So you find those who ban it, and then on the other hand, you find those who respect it and say things like, Torah cannot be translated into any other language properly except Greek. So you have competing sources on how the sages viewed Greek, competing views within the sages themselves. And in that context, let's take a look at source number two from the Jerusalem Talmud, emphasizing that it's the Jerusalem Talmud written, in other words, under the Romans, by people who are living under Roman control. Rabbi Avahu cited Rabbi Yochanan. You're dealing with then, call it 3rd century, I believe, maybe into the 4th, but I think 3rd. One may teach his daughter Greek, as opposed to his son, because the previous passage said, don't teach your son Greek, because he's supposed to be spending his time on Torah study. He shouldn't be involved in learning Greek. But your daughter, you can teach her Greek. This is ornamental for her. It's a beautiful thing for her. It'll help her get a good shidduch. It's great, you know, to be able to know Greek. So Shimon bar Abba heard this idea that Rabbi Avahu said, when he said, oh, you can teach her Greek. And he said, because Rabbi Avahu wants to teach his daughter Greek, he hung this upon Rabbi Yochanan. In other words, what he's alleging is Rabbi Avahu made it up. And only said that it was Rabbi Yochanan's teaching in order to give it legitimacy. You follow? Rabbi Avahu heard this and he said, he's swearing, may terrible things happen, he says, if I didn't hear this from Rabbi Yochanan. He swears that it's true that he heard it from Rabbi Yochanan, and the discussion continues briefly there in the Talmud. What's clear is that Rabbi Avahu is horrified at being accused of this sort of false attribution. I would never say Rabbi Yochanan said this if it wasn't true. That's his statement. That's on the one hand. And then on the other hand, take a look at source number three. Passage also from the Talmud, this one's the Babylonian. If you wish to be strangled, hang yourself by a tall tree. Which, you know, maybe advice in general. But the idea here, the meaning of this line as it's understood is, if you want people to accept your statements, if you want people to listen when you say such and such is the law, himself a tall tree, a sage who everybody respects, and tell people that he said it. He's telling you to do what Rabbi Avahu said. God forbid, I never would have done such a thing. Go ahead and tell people that it was said by a greater figure. There's actually an interesting paper that I read called Pseudepigraphy in Rabbinic Literature. It's available online by a writer, Mark Bregman, which talks about this issue. But that's what we're talking about here. The question of writing something and attributing it to somebody else so that people will accept it. And the first of the two cases we're going to discuss is a case known as Besamim Rosh. And that's what I gave you there on the sheet, where it says, Besamim Rosh. Besamim Rosh, literally, is a term referring to spices that smell good. When the Torah presents the instructions for making the incense they used in the temple, it begins, V'atah kach lecha besamim rosh. Take for yourself besamim rosh. If you're familiar with the blessing at Havdalah after Shabbat, borei minei besamim, that's the blessing on the sweet-smelling spices. Okay. The Besamim Rosh emerges at the end of the 18th century. What major philosophical movement is going on in European Jewry in the end of the 18th century? Hasidut is one. Good. I'm at the other end of the spectrum.
Reform.
Enlightenment, Haskalah. No, this is pre-reform. This is before reform. Reform is in another 15 to 20 years, 1806 in Hamburg. The Haskalah is a movement from Western Europe where Hasidut is developing in Eastern Europe. And what it is, essentially, is a shift inspired by secular enlightenment. And it's been brewing for ages before then. It's marked by a drive for secular learning and involvement in broader society. It is not a movement of reform. It is a movement of let's incorporate the new with the old. There is debate among historians as to whether Haskalah led to reform or whether they're actually two entirely different movements that happen to arise in the same place a couple of decades apart. It's its own discussion. It's an interesting one. But the Haskalah moves from west to east. It begins in Germany, and then it goes east, ultimately, to the Ukraine and to Russia over a period of decades. It's led by scholars who are educated in Torah, but want to liberalize it. And when you look at their arguments and their writings, they're having debates from classic sources, classic texts. They believe very much in the authority of Talmud. They just believe in explaining it their way. So that you can now start to see why it might have been in the interests of one of the scholars of this Haskalah to write something and to claim that it actually had been authored by somebody much earlier, somebody from this chain of Jewish tradition that they're all respecting, but presenting views consistent with the Haskalah. And that is exactly what seems to have happened in the case of the Besamim Rosh. I need to explain a little bit about another historical figure, somebody named Rabbeinu Asher, who is often known as the Rosh or the Rush, as it's usually pronounced, Reish Aleph Shin in Hebrew. Rabbeinu Asher was a leading rabbi in Germany in the end of the 13th century. End of the 13th century. He flees German persecution in the year 1303, and he heads for Spain, which is crucial. Because, as someone who was first a rabbi in Germany, and then becomes a rabbi in Spain, that means that he is a great authority for both the Ashkenazic world and the Sephardic world. His work, commenting on the Talmud, specifically on its law-oriented segments, becomes a monumental work that's consistently published in the back of the Talmud. As a matter of fact, well, I'll leave aside the matter of fact. He publishes hundreds upon hundreds of responsa, right? Answers to questions in Jewish law, which we have down till this day. And his son is Rabbi Yaakov Baal HaTurim, author of a work called the Tur, which was the key predecessor for the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. And what I'm trying to get at here with this, 2-minute synopsis about Rabbeinu Asher is, if I am living at the end of the 18th century, and I want to write a work which is going to claim that somebody within Jewish tradition believed my ideas, I can do very well by saying that it's Rabbeinu Asher, who was the author. Because he has Ashkenazi and Sephardi pedigree. He is known for his works of Jewish law, far and wide. He's tied into this chain of tradition that leads to the code of Jewish law. What he says is going to carry huge weight. Now you might say, well, why did he take Maimonides? And the answer probably is because Maimonides published way too much. Maimonides had written so much that everybody knew so much about that you really can't get away with coming up with a new work of responsa and saying this is Maimonides' work. That's number one. Number two, I think also probably because he didn't need to, because the Haskalah already claimed Maimonides as one of theirs, so to speak, because Maimonides was well-versed in Greek philosophy and ideas and secularly educated. They want to grab someone they didn't have already. they want to take somebody else. So I suspect that may be another reason why they go for it. So what happens is, and I'm just going to say this last point, and we're going to come back to this next time, God willing. In the year 1793, a book emerges. It is called Besamim Rosh. Literally, the spices of Rosh, the Rosh. This is Rabbeinu Asher. It has 392 responsa in it. I mentioned before the idea of turning Hebrew letters into numbers, right? Like A being 1 in English, B being 2, so Aleph being 1, Bet being 2. The word besamim, the numerical value is 392. So it will be one of these types of weaving it into the title references. It's published by Rabbi Shaul, son of Rabbi Zvi Hirsch Berlin. Rabbi Zvi Hirsch Berlin was the head of the rabbinical court of Berlin. This is his son. He tells a story when he publishes it. He says, I found this work. I can't get the original manuscript. I only have a copy that Rabbi Yitzchak of Molina made from an original manuscript that's buried in some library in Europe. And I am now bringing it to light along with my commentary that I'm going to publish on it. He has a commentary called Kasa Daharsana, which literally means a cup of fish. I kid you not. It's a cup of fish that they used to, it was a delicacy in Talmudic times. But he says, I am publishing this from a copy, from a manuscript in some library in Europe. And he says, this is the work of the Rosh, of Rabbeinu Asher. And next time, God willing, we will come back to this to talk about what happened with this, what he was trying to achieve, as well as to talk about a second example of this pseudepigraphy before we go on to a little bit of our last topic, which is 21st century Jewish publishing. So, God willing, we'll get a little bit of that in as well next week. Thank you very much.